Canadians seem to have forgotten that one of the reasons for the parliamentary structure of government is to establish the responsibility to the people rather than rule or control by the unelected, whether it's the monarchy or the judiciary.
On the feature interview today, a panel discussion featuring some in-depth reflection and analysis of the Supreme Court decision in the Carter case, the ruling that essentially legalized doctor-assisted suicide in Canada. We look both at the ruling and at potential next steps. On the news portion of the program, a call for more action on end-of-life care in the wake of the Carter ruling. Ontario's premier throws out a blatant insult to parents who've expressed concerns over that province's new sex education curriculum. In media news, a new enterprise rising from the ashes of the Sun News Network. And down in the States, signals that the U.S. Supreme Court is about to impose a blanket nationwide endorsement of homosexual marriage.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
The after effects of the so-called Carter decision continue to ripple through the political system. On February 6th, the Supreme Court of Canada threw out a section of the criminal code which made it a crime to help someone kill themselves. The NDP says that ruling again proves the need for a comprehensive national strategy on end-of-life and palliative care for terminally ill Canadians. Last fall, New Democrat MP Charlie Angus introduced a motion in the Commons calling for the establishment of such a strategy. That motion passed almost unanimously, but since then, nothing has been done. The NDP is now putting pressure on the Harper government to actually do something on the issue. In fact, when I spoke to Mr. Angus on the weekend by cell phone as he was driving from Ottawa back to his home near Timmins, he told me the lack of concrete action by the government last year was a missed opportunity in the context of the Carter case.
If the government had taken action following our palliative care motion, if they had shown that they were dealing with end-of-life issues, I think the argument could have been made at the Supreme Court. Listen, we are putting steps in place, not on the issue of assisted suicide, but on the broader issue. But in that vacuum, we now have action that has to be taken, dictated by the courts on assisted suicide. How can we move on that if we're not going to be moving on the larger issues of palliative and hospice care?
Angus says his party is launching a national campaign in advance of this fall's election to try to get something done on the issue.
We've launched the Promises to Promise campaign to get grassroots organizations and people across the country to start pushing their members of parliament saying, where are you on this issue? We need to show a more holistic, cohesive response, especially in light of the Supreme Court. We're going to be pushing it as the Democratic Party. My colleague Murray Rankin is pushing for action at the Health Committee to start talking about what are we going to do about a palliative strategy? What does it look like? And this will certainly play out in the coming election. People are going to be checking the various parties for where they stand on this.
We'll have more on the Carter case later in the broadcast, a panel discussion which will include the former board chair of Canada's Christian Legal Fellowship. In other news, the questions continue in Ontario about the government's new sex education program for the school system. The issue came up again in the legislature last week with Lambton-Kent Middlesex MPP Monty McNaughton, who's running for the Ontario PC leadership, going after Premier Wynne in question period.
Premier, on November 18th in this House,
Minister of Agriculture,
you affirmed that your government had established a process to consult with parents on proposed changes to the Liberal sex education curriculum. But Premier, over the past 3 months, I've heard from thousands of parents from across Ontario who have told me that no such consultation took place. And Premier, that the period for consultation is now over. Premier, why did you suggest to this House that you expected the chairs of each school council to consult with parents on the sex ed curriculum when this was, by the order of your Minister of Education, never going to happen?
Well, Mr. Speaker, let me just be clear. We were, and the Minister of Education was very clear, that all of the schools in the province, all 5,000 schools, the school council chairs, were being asked to take part in a consultation. That means that every region of the province, Mr. Speaker, every school council chair had access to the consultation process, Mr. Speaker. And that is exactly what happened. And we have completed that process, Mr. Speaker.
Wynne went further, though, after McNaughton pressed the issue in a supplementary question, insisting that parents were patently not informed of what would be in the curriculum. The Premier called into question not just his integrity, but also the motivation of thousands of Christian parents who are worried about what will be in that curriculum.
I'm not sure what the real agenda of the member opposite is. I'm not sure if the fear-mongering has more to do with his leadership campaign, Mr. Speaker, or whether it has to do with a very small group of people, Mr. Speaker, who want to stir up fear about the reality that kids need information. They need to understand how human beings relate to each other, Mr. Speaker, and they need to get that information based on science.
So far, it's still unclear exactly what the curriculum will contain. An earlier draft presented by Wynne when she was education minister had to be withdrawn after a storm of protest because it featured explicit sexuality and what parents considered age-inappropriate content for kids as young as 6 and 7 years old. Canada's media landscape got a little smaller last week. The Sun News Network folded up its operations, citing continued financial losses and an inability to find a buyer for the broadcast outlet. But something is already rising from the ashes. Sun's high-profile editorialist, Ezra Levant, has launched a new web-only video channel at therebel.media.
You know the saying, you can curse the darkness or you can light a candle. I am mourning the loss of the Sun, best job I ever had, most amazing colleagues, most passionate viewers, most loyal friends. But now what? I don't have tens of millions of dollars to start a new TV station. I don't have political connections to the CRTC. I don't have $1 billion a year in corporate welfare bailouts like the CBC gets. So what can I do? I mean, I don't even have a studio. I am literally standing in my house right now. How pitiful is that? Well, actually, it's not pitiful at all. Actually, it's pretty exciting, because while being an official TV channel has its perks, it also has its drawbacks. It's regulated by political hacks at the government, CRTC. It has bossy censors, politically correct wieners at the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. And, of course, you only get onto those TV sets that cable companies allow you to do. And on the channel placement of their choosing and at the price they grudgingly agree to pay you, all of those hurdles, all of those barriers, and for what? For a medium that is quickly being eclipsed by the internet.
Analysts say Sun TV's biggest problem was the CRTC's refusal to grant the network so-called mandatory carriage on Canada's cable systems. In other words, people were being forced to pay extra for the channel when its competitors were being delivered to virtually every Canadian home for free as part of the basic cable package. And one thing more, in the U.S., the Supreme Court has signaled it's about to impose a blanket nationwide endorsement of homosexual marriage. The court has agreed to hear arguments in June about whether it's constitutionally legal for individual states to ban same-sex marriages. In more than 30 states, lower courts have already determined that laws against the idea are unconstitutional, often in spite of ballot measures where voters overwhelmingly approved of the ban. Reverend Garland Hunt, who succeeded Chuck Colson as the head of prison fellowship last year, told a Family Research Council gathering in Washington last week that this is an issue where there can be no compromise and where there's more at stake than the notion of democratic rights.
Voting is important and necessary, but there is going to come a time where we have to defy what we believe, even if the court isn't saying it or even the government isn't saying it. This is what we are saying. And we cannot compromise what we believe under any circumstance. So it has to be a massive group of people together that determines we are going to stand on this, and marriage is one of those areas. God created marriage, therefore he's the only one that can define it.
The potentially extreme consequences of this? Former Libertarian U.S. presidential candidate Ron Paul weighed in last week, saying if the Supreme Court does strike down all the bans, it could lead to a secession movement where individual states will choose to ignore the court and maybe opt to try to break away from the union if necessary. More after this.
ARPA Canada is hiring. We have two job openings. The first is for a full-time policy analyst, and the second is for a part-time assistant for the We Need a Law campaign. Do you have what it takes to write, present, and lobby for ARPA Canada? Or perhaps you're more behind the scenes and would like to help the We Need a Law campaign part-time with research and social media. Detailed job descriptions are available on our website. We'd love to hear from you. Email Mark Cunningham at mark@arpacanada.ca. lighthouse.ca to submit your resume.
And we're back on the program. A couple of special guests with me on the line today, both from Ottawa. Andre Schutten, fairly familiar to Lighthouse News listeners. He is, of course, the lawyer of record for ARPA Canada. Also on the line, Don Hutchinson. Don's been a member of the Law Society of Upper Canada since 1990, also a longtime member and former board chair of Canada's Christian Legal Fellowship. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Al.
The Carter case, the decision is now a couple of weeks old. We've had some time to look at it and review it, but I'd like to start by asking each one of you for your first impressions of the ruling. What was the first thing that crossed your mind when you read this? For me, and I'm not a lawyer, but I was just troubled that the language in the decision seemed to be quite a bit broader than simply addressing the circumstances of the Carter case. Don, let's start with you.
Well, first, I was struck that all nine judges had agreed. It's very rare for the Supreme Court of Canada to issue a unanimous decision, especially on something as complex as this case is. So then I started reading, and in reading for the logical development of the law on this matter, the written decision was inexplicably over. It was done before that development took place. It's very short, only 57 pages on what should have been a very complex legal analysis. And then 5 pages, bizarrely, reviewing the law on awarding costs. It's out of balance. And that led to, on finishing reading it, it led to one of the first things I posted on social media, which was, the Carter decision affirms that the most dangerous person in the Canadian legal system is the trial judge, the person who determines what the facts of the case will be. The Supreme Court of Canada, in this decision, has given greater deference to the conclusions of the trial judge than they did to a Senate study on the issue, which resulted in a report, or the deliberations of the House of Commons on 6 different occasions following the Rodriguez decision of the Supreme Court in 1993.
Andre, what about you? What were your first impressions?
It was, oh no, oh no, oh no, as I was reading through it. I was particularly struck by their conclusion in the end to strike down the 2 provisions concerning assisted suicide and consent to your own death, and how broad it was. Now, they have left it open to Parliament to narrow that back down again, but should Parliament not act, which is not outside the realm of possibilities here, then we have one of the most liberalized assisted suicide jurisdiction in the world. So it was just a broad, wide open way in which they struck down the law such that you could pretty much drive a Mack truck through the new provisions if Parliament does nothing.
You know, hindsight is 20/20. We just had Charlie Angus on the show a few minutes ago. He says not dealing with Motion 456, the whole end of life issue, was a missed opportunity. He figures that if Parliament had taken up the end of life care issue more vigorously, the Carter ruling might have been different or maybe a little more nuanced. Any reaction to that from either of you?
Yeah, I would suggest that it's not quite that simple. I agree that it is a missed opportunity, and hopefully moving forward, Parliament does incorporate palliative care in its response to this judgment. But the Crown did argue that, in fact, palliative care, Motion 456, was voted on and supported by all but 2 members of Parliament as one more indication that Parliament is dealing with this issue. And I think at the time of the hearing, October of last year, it would have been too early for them to have indicated one way or the other that Parliament had time to act on that motion. But certainly now, and at the present, I think Parliament now has the opportunity to say, yeah, let's move forward vigorously with a national palliative care strategy.
And certainly the Parliamentary Committee on Palliative and Compassionate Care has produced a wonderful report. It's an all-party report that was submitted to the House of Commons that deals with this issue very thoroughly, and it seems to me that the court was determined to move in a certain direction regardless of the opinions of Parliament. As I said earlier, they ignored the 6 debates that have taken place in Parliament over the last 20 years.
Okay, I know this is the Supreme Court, and there is no appeal beyond this in terms of the Canadian legal system, but you guys are both lawyers. If you were able to craft some kind of an appeal of this ruling, hypothetically, on what basis would this Supreme Court of Canada ruling possibly still be challenged? What would be the legal grounds you might look at and say, you know what, the Supreme Court messed up here, here, and here on these points?
Well, technically, the government could ask for a rehearing, but they're not likely to get it. The government's also in a position to request clarity from the court. there is a great debate going on right now in the legal community over the conclusion of the Supreme Court in regard to sections 14 and 241B. It's not clear whether the court is giving 12 months before the sections are struck down completely or only void in regard to physician-assisted death for a competent adult as described in the decision. In the past, the court has used similar language for both intended results, but has given greater clarification as to its intent and the reasons, and that clarification is missing in the reasons here. If the decision could be appealed to a higher court, then there are several weaknesses in the legal reasoning. The court conflated or confused the two concepts of an underlying charter value, in this case, sanctity of life, a foundational principle for all charter rights, with the concept of an interpretive charter value, in this case, personal autonomy. Interpretive charter values are something that can be limited by the state within constitutional boundaries, but foundational or underlying charter values were intended to be permanent and ongoing. The court also made a quantum leap of logic or illogic in deciding that the right of a patient to accept or refuse medical treatment could be equated with requesting physician assistance in dying. Those are two very, very different things. The court describes the purpose of the criminal code sections in question as being for the protection of the vulnerable. When Parliament, and it was recognized by the court in the Rodriguez case in 1993, recognized that the sections actually serve two objectives. The protection of the vulnerable is one, and the other is the preservation of human life. So the question is, what did the court do with the parliamentary objective of the preservation of human life? It didn't even comment on it.
Andre, any contributions to this?
I would also make an appeal more on philosophical, political grounds, and that is to appeal the Supreme Court's findings here by cross-referencing the Constitution of 1867, which sets out the framework under which all laws and decisions should be made. And in that Constitution, it sets out the role of the courts and the roles of the legislature. And I find in this particular case, I don't think I would get much traction in this particular Supreme Court, but perhaps a higher court would find that the Supreme Court actually overstepped its bounds by quite a lot, by not deferring to the work that Parliament has done on this issue already, as Don mentioned, six times in the last 20 years. And they should have left legislating on social issues to Parliament, and they could have left judicial reasoning to the courts.
Agreed.
So going forward, what's next? I mean, the politicians have been told they've got a year to rewrite Section 241B. And let's leave aside the question of the notwithstanding clause for a minute, but what could a rewrite like that possibly look like, given the fact that the courts essentially said the notion of aiding and abetting suicide should no longer be a criminal offense? How do we still write some regulations or rules or policy or maybe review panels like we used to do with abortions? Parliament doesn't have a lot of wiggle room here.
Without using the notwithstanding clause, Parliament may use its constitutional authority of criminalization to criminalize all acts of assistance in suicide, except those noted by the court. After that, it gets tricky, because based on the court's decision a few years ago in regard to the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, regulation of how the process of physician-assisted death would unfold in practice would likely be a matter of provincial jurisdiction under the constitutional provisions for health care, and that would require federal-provincial negotiation.
Andre?
Don raises a very good point there, referencing the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, and that is that in order for this to work and work well, Parliament is going to have to negotiate or interact with the provinces on this, not only as it relates to assisted suicide and how we frame the limits, but also as it relates to palliative care and a national palliative care strategy. And that takes time. And what the Supreme Court has given Parliament, they say they've given Parliament 12 months to do something, but in actual effect, they've given them less than five, because the reality is that halfway through this process, there's going to be an election. So in 5 months, how in the world is a legislature or the parliament supposed to come up with a robust, well-thought-out response to this issue that includes consultation with 10 very different provinces? How is that going to happen? It's probably not going to happen to the extent that we would like. But that being said, I do hope that we see movement on a palliative care strategy. I hope we see very stringent safeguards. In fact, the Supreme Court even said in their judgment, they said that the inherent risks in allowing physician-assisted suicide can be substantially minimized, they said, as long as there are limits that are scrupulously monitored and enforced. And so it's up to Parliament to come up with these scrupulously monitored and enforced limits. And a few things that we would hope to see is very clear limits on who's allowed to be assisted in their suicide. So terminal illness should probably be a requirement. Physical incapability of taking your own life should probably be a requirement. Some sort of review panel of both physicians and possibly also a judge to make sure that the decision to assist someone in their death is both a medical and a legal one. And also requiring contemporaneous consent should be a requirement. That simply means that consent has to be present throughout the entire process, and especially right at the moment of death. We can't say someone, well, they implied consent 5 years ago, therefore we're going to off this person now. That should be a no-no. And finally, I would say we should hope to see videotaped evidence of the entire process from the very beginning of a request for assisted death, evidence captured on video of the doctors offering alternatives, including palliative care, video evidence of the hearings, video evidence of the lethal injection and the pronouncement of death. And that video evidence should be available to anyone in Canada on request from the government in order to, again, ensure that consent is present through the entire process, that alternatives are offered, and that no doctor is acting outside of the law. So we need a very robust system, a well-thought-out, complicated system. And unless we can do that, I'm afraid for where we're going to be headed in the short term.
Let's take a look at the notwithstanding clause issued. You know, within 24 hours of the Carter decision, there was an online petition launched. LifeSite News and people like that had it saying, you know what, Parliament has to enact Section 33. We've got to override this. Is this the only sort of realistic legal option? And tied to that, we've got an election coming. And, you know, some polls show 80%. And I know the questions, you know, polls are what they are. John Diefenbaker said something about them. But still, there seems to be considerable public opinion out there that says a lot of Canadians appeared to be in favor of some kind of easing of the restrictions of euthanasia. So with the election coming, you know, imposing the notwithstanding clause in this context, politically speaking, is it even palatable?
Section 33 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that we call the notwithstanding clause is there for a reason. Without it, Canada is no longer a parliamentary democracy. Canada has been described as having become a constitutional democracy on April 17, 1982, when the Charter came into being. But the intent of Section 33 was to ensure that the interpretation of the Constitution by the courts would never be able to supersede the people's elected legislatures, whether parliament or provincial. The federal government has never used the clause, and the provincial governments that have, except for Quebec, have not fared well after using it. Canadians seem to have forgotten that one of the reasons for the parliamentary structure of government is to establish the responsibility to the people rather than rule or control by the unelected, whether it's the monarchy or the judiciary. Second, on the polling data on this issue is all over the map. People tend to favor physician-assisted suicide over assisted suicide provided by non-physicians. They also tend to favor palliative care over assisted suicide when that form of medical treatment is properly explained. So most of the polling data has not taken place with properly developed blind, neutral, and informed questions asked of a large sampling and a broad cross-section of Canadians, but rather they've had this narrow, almost predetermined questioning. In any event, are we governed by the polls or by our elected representatives? And this is the question that raises Section 33 or the notwithstanding clause. Are we governed by the courts or by our elected representatives? If the issue isn't dealt with in time because of the election that's scheduled for this October, then Parliament can request an extension from the court, or they can use the notwithstanding clause to create for themselves a period of study and drafting on the issue, or simply use the notwithstanding clause to keep sections 14 and 241B intact as they are. Those are the options in regard to the notwithstanding clause from my perspective. Is it reasonable? I don't expect that it will be used, but if ever there was a time, I think now is it, because the foundational principle of the sanctity of life, the respect for human worth and dignity, has been overturned by the court in this case.
Andre, is it politically palatable to use the notwithstanding clause? How do you see the melding of the politics and the law on this one?
I think that the only way it's going to be used will be if we are nearly running out of time, and if the Conservatives and the NDP can work together to come out together with one voice and say, no, it's in everyone's best interest, progressives and Conservatives together, to say, in order to protect the most amount of lives, the most vulnerable in this country, we need more time. And so if the notwithstanding clause is used and its use is framed in that context, that yes, we're going to deal with this decision, yes, we're going to respond to what the Supreme Court has said, but we just need more time, and they craft the use of the notwithstanding clause with a 2-year window or something like that in order to study robustly this issue, then I think that Canadians would actually be okay with that. But I would guess that if that step is taken, it wouldn't be taken until after the election in October. Before that time, I think that Parliament might try to pass something, but it'll be a bit rushed and it won't be as robust as we'd like.
Gentlemen, speaking of running out of time, we have run out of time. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us, Al.
Well, thank you, Al.
All right.
Bye now.
Just one more thing as a programming note. Starting next week, Lighthouse News goes to weekly delivery. Stay tuned for that. The programs are going to become more frequent.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Production manager, Brian Grimm. Technical director, Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage. Or you can send us an email, info@arpaccanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.